I think almost everyone is served and seated, so I'd like to start. It's already noon. Thank you all for coming today. I know it's the holidays and it's a busy time of the year, so yeah, go ahead straight that way. It's a busy time of the year, and being able to attend this, it's really appreciated. I'll just give a brief introduction to just myself and some of the staff at GTI. I'm Melissa Newcomb. I'm the research manager here. And I'd like to thank my fellow staff. Russell, I'm not sure where he is. He's our executive director. I really appreciate his support for us, staff, to pursue our own research and to put on events like this. Lily, our office director, and Anna Scott Bell, our program associate, thank you so much for all your support to make these things happen. To go into the topic itself, I became interested in this because of my research on gender issues. And when I started to look at Taiwan, I realized that there are a lot of similarities between what Taiwan is doing in terms of economics and what Japan is doing. And in Japan, these are called womenomic policies. First coined by Kathy Matsui in 1999 and revitalized by Prime Minister Abe in 2013. So I thought it would be interesting and fruitful to kind of draw comparisons and to find what is working for Japan and Taiwan in terms of these policies, how it's impacting those countries, and ultimately what the US can learn, because we obviously are kind of behind in a lot of these areas. So I'd like to introduce our speakers. Right next to me we have Shihoko Goto, a senior associate at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Asia program focused on Northeast Asia. She's responsible for the program's research and publications on South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. She's a contributing editor for The Globalist and has 10 years of experience in journalism, focusing on international political economy with a focus on Asian markets. In 2015, she hosted an event very similar to this on the challenges and opportunities for female leaders and executives in East Asia. And if you're interested in this topic in general, I really recommend going to the Woodrow Wilson Center website and looking that up. It was very informative and I enjoyed it a lot. So thank you, Shoko. After Shoko, we have Abigail Friedman, founder and CEO of the Wisteria Group, an international advisory firm. One of the core values of the Wisteria Group is the advancement of women's economic development internationally. And she has 25 years of experience as a diplomat for the US with postings all over the world, but specifically in Japan. She's a senior associate for CSIS and a senior advisor for the Asia Foundation, supporting women's empowerment team, especially on their strategic engagement with Japan. And last but certainly not least, we have Gloria Kuo. She joins us from the political division at the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office, TECRO, in DC. And she was formerly at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Her portfolio includes women's empowerment with a focus on identifying and facilitating where the US and Taiwan can work together to empower women both at home and abroad. So I'm really happy to have these three experts here with me today to talk about this topic. And I'd like to open with Shihoko. If you could just speak on the broad regional trends when it comes to female labor participation in Asia and Taiwan's place in that.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa, and thank you to the Global Taiwan Institute for organizing this event. I also want to congratulate the Institute for its establishment. Taiwan is certainly in the headlines these days, and we can't talk enough about the future of cross-strait relations. But the importance, the significance of the Institute goes really beyond that. It doesn't simply focus on geopolitical risk. When we talk about U.S.-Taiwan relations, we really talk about the shared values between the two sides. Those include democracy, rule of law, free markets, and also a commitment to decreasing the gender divide. And I think this is a very important theme as we are reaching a seemingly huge juncture in establishing a new international liberal order. Taiwan, I believe, is actually ahead of the curve on many gender issues. After all, the United States has yet to break that ultimate glass ceiling, whilst Tsai Ing-wen is actually the president of Taiwan. But of course, female leadership in Asia is new. We have, at least for now, still in South Korea, Park Geun-hye. We end in Europe. We have Angela Merkel, Theresa May. Historically, too, though, in Asia, we've had a lot of female leaders, including Indira Gandhi, to name but a few. But Tsai Ing-wen is groundbreaking insofar as she is self-made. She has no family connections. She does not have any dynastic ties. She very much is her own person in climbing to the pinnacle of power. So she is an inspiration for women, not just in Taiwan, but across Asia and beyond. And one of her legacies, regardless of what happens with the cross-strait relations, will be how she shapes how women are perceived in society. Now, I am not a gender expert. My focus is very much on the political economy. And for my brief time here, I want to concentrate on two points. Firstly, why it makes financial sense to have women at the highest levels of government and in business, and the need for a trickle-down as much as a bottom-up approach to female empowerment. And then secondly, how diversity, including gender, leads to profits. Now, the first one, the financial case for female empowerment. Traditionally, the challenges of empowering women has come from a human rights perspective. So we focus on issues that are related to social justice, and we talk about access to educational opportunities, healthcare, voice in government. And in terms of education and legal rights, East Asia has actually done very well. Now, but the game-changing aspect was really when we introduced the economic angle. And as Melissa mentioned, Kathy Mitsui's work is perhaps best known, and she's certainly credited for coining the term economics at the turn of the century. It was particularly powerful because it came from the first female partner of Goldman Sachs. Of course, Goldman Sachs, as we know, is about to, it has a tremendous influence on the US economy and not just on Wall Street. So when someone like Kathy Mitsui focuses on why Japan needs to unleash the potential of women to ensure its competitiveness on the global stage, people listen. And her studies have really focused not about fairness or about equal opportunities because it's the right thing to do, but she's really focused on why it makes financial sense, given the reality in Japan that the population is shrinking by 30%, and those over the age of 65 will make up to 40% of the population by 2060. In a country where the debt-to-GDP ratio is one of the highest amongst the OECD countries. So tapping into the potential of Japan's existing highly educated population makes sense, especially by Goldman's calculation, it could raise Japan's GDP by 13%. So closing that gender employment gap suddenly takes on a new meaning as well as urgency. Now, the possibility of more women joining the workforce and boosting competitiveness is not unique to Japan. McKinsey's research arm, McKinsey Global Institute, estimates that reducing labor force participation rate increased would actually add about $12 trillion to the global economy, and well over $4.3 trillion in the United States alone. So then, given those facts, rankings of women in leadership position, women contributing to society, actually starts making more sense, and it takes on greater importance. So this year, the World Economic Forum put Japan in 111th place in terms of gender parity. South Korea is in 116th place. Mainland China is in 99th place. Taiwan is not part of the World Economic Forum's calculations, but looking at the calculations by Taipei from last year, it probably ranks around 40th to 45th place. The United States is around 45. So there's a lot of scope for improvement by all countries, but especially in Northeast Asia. And the question then becomes, well, if they go up the ranks, it's not just about national pride. It actually could be, could it be a potential solution to jumpstart growth? Could it be a solution to boost domestic demand and to offset this export-led growth type of model of economic growth? Northeast Asian countries are all in the same boat in similar degrees, in varying degrees. All face the tremendous challenge of shrinking populations, aging demographics. Japan obviously is the most severe, but Korea and Taiwan are not far behind. And at the same time, Tokyo, Seoul, and Taipei have not seen a large-scale acceptance of immigrants as part of this solution to the demographic challenge, especially when they monitor the challenges of migration facing Europe and the United States. So tapping into the existing resource of women really makes sense, especially when Japanese, Korean, and Taiwanese women are incredibly well educated. Often they're a lot smarter than men. And of course, there have been numerous public policies introduced over the years so that women can make headway in the workforce. And in Japan, since 1985, with the introduction of the Equal Employment Opportunity Law, Japanese women have had more opportunities to make way into the labor market. And today, according to the ILO, the International Labor Organization, they make up about 49% of the workforce. In the United States, according to the ILO, it's about 56%. But there are two problems. One is that women stay on in their jobs into their 30s and beyond, and then climb into positions of greater seniority and influence as they stay on, so that there is a career trajectory. And then secondly, to make sure that even if they do leave for maternity leave or for other reasons, there are opportunities to return to employment. There are many obstacles for women climbing up the corporate ladder, long hours, no on-off ramp for careers for people on career tracks to take a breather. There is essentially a lack of flexibility in the labor market. Once those issues are addressed, there could be more women in the workplace, and it could also lead for men as well as women to reconsider their career trajectories, which would lead to greater diversity in the workplace as well. And I want to come now to the second point, which is about the quantitative impact of diversity. Diversity should have an economic value to just as much as gender parity should have. And we have seen that companies with a more diverse board are more successful. And McKinsey has found that amongst the Fortune 500 companies in the United States, the top 25% for gender diversity are more likely to have financial returns above their industry medians. But we should also note that companies in the top 25% of those of that poll for racial diversity are likely to find a 35% increase in their returns above the national industry medians. Now, right now, there is almost a cookie-cutter approach to the idea of work in a lot of Asian countries. And what constitutes success as an executive, as a bureaucrat, as a policymaker, are fairly narrowly defined. And those assumptions really need to be challenged. After all, the global markets that we want to approach, the consumers that we want to approach across borders have eclectic taste. Those who have a deep understanding of markets, of governance outside their own borders, are going to be more competitive. And it should be the case that leadership in the private as well as private sectors should be diverse as well. One final thought before I turn over to the panelists. I want to point out that the election of Donald Trump could actually be an opportunity in this case. Trump is, he is many things, and he is not many things. But one thing that I think we have a consensus about is that he is not an ideologue, and he is a pragmatist. And on the other hand, there's a lot of discussion about a divided America and a divided world. And there are those who embrace globalization and those who fear it. And the challenge for those of us who believe in gender parity and greater diversity is to make the case for the success of diversity. And I mean diversity in terms of gender, race, age, also education. And to make the case that plurality will actually make countries as well as businesses stronger, and it will make them more competitive. And I also believe that female empowerment is not just a woman's issue, and it's certainly not just a family issue, it's of national interest. Countries succeed by being more flexible, especially in an innovation-driven economy. So with that.
Thank you so much, Shoko, for that introduction into the issue itself, and also bringing in the idea of diversity beyond gender, because I think that is something that's often overlooked in general. Abigail, could you give us a little bit more detail, though, on Japan and what they're doing in regards to these womenomic policies today?
Great, thank you so much, and thank you for putting this panel together. I think it's wonderful. Often we tend to look at just Japan, and I think it's very valuable to look at these issues in terms of Japan in the broader international context. How is it doing compared to other countries? What policies around the world would be helpful for Japan? Which ones would not fit? So thank you for hosting this, and thank you all for coming today. Where to begin? There's so much on this issue. So let me just touch on a few things. First, there are three different, I'm actually going to start with the end, and it's something that you touched on, Shihoko, which is that this issue of women in the workforce is actually, as I see it, a three-legged stool. There are economic reasons for a country to bring women into the workforce. There is good business reasons to bring women in the workforce. That's the diversity issue. And the third is there's a human rights issue that to sort of not understand that women are a part of society and everyone has a right to choices in work is to really miss the point. So those three aspects are key. What's really happening in Japan now is Japan has a prime minister, Shinzo Abe, who has really led on the issue of getting women in the workforce in a really impressive way. He has taken a lot of the work and thinking that has been going on for a while and made that center stage in the national conversation in Japan. If anyone goes to the Gender Equality Bureau, I think that's what it is, the Cabinet Office, and looks at some of the statistical analysis of what the challenges are to bringing women in the workforce, you will see that there is a very thoughtful, comprehensive understanding of the issue that addresses all aspects. Women and having childcare available, having work-life balance, getting more men working at home, being more responsive to the needs of a diverse workforce. So they understand the issue. The downside is that the Abe government's approach is really focused on only one leg of the stool, and that's the economic argument. That if you bring women into the workforce, Japan's GDP will increase from anywhere from 13 to 15%. That's the Goldman Sachs analysis. It's excellent stuff, and it doesn't pretend to be more than what it's doing. But the reality is that the focus of the Japanese government right now is purely on the economic argument. And I think that at this point, we can talk about it perhaps later in the discussion, that unless those other two pieces of the puzzle, the diversity, the value to growing businesses of having a diverse workforce, unless that is addressed, unless people really embrace the human rights aspect, you're not going to get the cultural change on the human rights aspect that is necessary, and you're not going to get the business really understanding how to embrace this issue, the diversity aspect. So in some ways I've started with the conclusion. Let's step back a little and look at what your question was. Can I take this to a more granular level? And
just some details about
yeah. And so so there I talk about myths. There was for a long time this myth that Japanese women weren't working. You know, many Japanese people, you ask the person on the street, you know, how do you think the percentage of women in the workforce is in Japan compared to other countries? They would probably tell you, well, you know, women stay home in Japan, we have babies. There's this whole kind of mantra. But the reality is that the percentage of women in the workforce, even 10, 15 years ago, was in the 60-some percent range, which was low for OECD countries. But it has now moved up to, I think, the latest figures, and they vary depending on the studies, by the way, so I hate to give precise numbers, but it was about 66.7%, which is comparable, and in some studies, say, exceeds that in the U.S. So the issue is not that women aren't working or that there is a cultural resistance to women actually working in Japan. The challenge is the kind of work they're doing. The reality is that most of the work that Japanese women are doing is part-time work, and these are jobs that lack a career track. So that's one myth. To unpack that myth, how do you address that? And that's again what the government is trying to target. If we understand that the problem isn't getting women to actually work, but it's to make sure that they have growth career opportunities and that they can get into full-time jobs, then for women who are having children, you need to address the daycare issue. That's why the Prime Minister's office has put such a priority on growing the number of daycare positions available. And they have made progress on that. So, you know, you still need more, but it's moving in the right direction. That touches on myth number two, which is that women in Japan don't really want to work. They would prefer to stay home. Now, I have to say that, you know, you might ask women in the U.S., would you rather stay home, you know? And there are probably a lot of us who would say, yes, I just was watching this Ali Wong.
Oh, she's very funny.
You know, and I gotta say, yeah, so she's a comedian. Especially this holiday season, I don't think we want to pull. But more seriously, the idea of women not wanting to work, Japanese government did a study and polled women, and there were about 3 million women who responded that they would really want to work. And the two areas, reasons holding them back, one was the sort of general child care and elder care, that was insufficient. They didn't have an answer to that. And so unless someone could help them address that issue, it was hard for them to work. That was one reason why women weren't working. And another reason was, I think it was hard for me to, it was a very vague thing in the Japanese. It's sort of like the job didn't really fit what they, didn't fit with them. And so I don't know how much of that meant that there was not a career track for them, or they were being offered jobs. I think what it meant, frankly, is that they were being offered jobs that weren't really meaningful to what they felt they could do. But I'd like to see more studies on what precisely that was. So again, so we can say, well, 3 million isn't the whole number of women that need to be brought into the workforce for Womenomics to have its economic effect, but it's a good place to start, and the Prime Minister's office is starting with that. I'm trying to think of there was a third myth, which I wrote down. A third myth that I think people now widely understand is that that many people had this idea that if women work, they wouldn't have babies. And Japan has a two-pronged, in some ways, obviously they're related. One is shrinking population, right? So if you have a shrinking population issue, you need to have either more babies or immigration, which I'm happy to talk about later. So there's the shrinking population problem, and there's the shrinking economy problem. And there is a relationship. It's not entirely one-to-one, but obviously if your population increases, you have more workers, you bring in more taxes, and the economy is able to grow. So that myth that if women work, they won't have babies, I actually think that held back a lot of sound policy making for many years. I will tell you an anecdote. In the early 1990s, I spoke with a very senior Diet member who had influence on a lot of things, and I was asking him about what Japan's policies were to address the shrinking population. And I actually was citing some of the French policies to incentivize having children. And he basically turned to me and said, well, women just need to have more babies. Women need to do their duty and have more babies, which I think actually was a very common sense, you know, that this whole thing would work if women just had more babies. It wasn't connected to workforce issues. And so if you really have that sense, then, and you think that women in the workforce is going to reduce the birth rate, then there are not going to be many policies to incentivize women in the workforce. There are going to be policies to incentivize the ability of women to do a little bit of work and still have babies. And those are exactly the policies that were put in place that today the Japanese government is trying to slowly change. You know, one of them was a tax incentive, so women could work a little bit, and you would actually, if you worked a little bit, you would get a tax benefit, tax break. The problem is that then now has become a straitjacket because it's a disincentive to women working full time. Initially, it was put in place to help women and two-earner families, and now it's a problem. The other is having these two tracks of regular employment and non-regular employment, which again was put in place to help women go into the workforce so that they could do a little bit of work, but they would not be so burdened that they couldn't be the full-time caregiver of their children. That too has become a straitjacket. Because too often women are put on that track, and more importantly, women are now welcome to go into the other track. In fact, people are trying to get women into the other track, but until that other track adapts to work-life balance, adapts to family-friendly approaches, you're not going to get as many women as you would like into that career track. To put it into the broader international context, and I will, you know, give a little. In the 50s, around the world, it was true that women generally either worked or stayed home and had families. That was true in the U.S. as well. When I was growing up, I was kind of on the very tail end of this. Since, you know, in high school there were women who were going to have careers, and then there were women who wanted to have families. And when I tell young women that today, they're kind of surprised. but in fact, that was kind of the mindset that people had. In reality, of course, we all kind of, the ones who thought that they were going to stay home realized that from economic reasons, that wasn't going to happen, and they started getting into the workforce. And the ones who thought they were just going to work, like me, fell in love, got married, and had kids. And so there we were, all, you know, doing a little of everything. But that was an international trend. Sometime in the late 70s, 80s, as women started coming into the workforce in the U.S. and other places, the policies started to adapt to address this. As more women came into the workforce, they pushed for different policies, and the workforce started to change. That did not happen in the way it needed to in Japan. And I think that is one of the problems. That's why I'm excited about the policy efforts to make the policy changes, because those policy changes were not really happening the way they needed to. And so while you had this sort of crossover point in the 80s, where after the 80s, women, it was not a clear cut, if women are in the workforce, your national birth rate is lower. It's actually a much more complex situation. That shift didn't happen in Japan. So those are some of the things I wanted to touch on, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Abigail, for the comprehensive overview of what's happening in Japan in regards to womanomics. So Gloria, I will ask you to kind of give the same on Taiwan. What's the current situation, some context, and any of your thoughts?
Hi everyone. So first, I would like to thank Melissa and GTI for giving TechPro, Gloria, and giving me this opportunity to talk about these important issues. And so I think nothing more clearly to demonstrate the women empowerment in Taiwan than the election we had in January this year. So we had Dr. Tsai. She really, you know, had no any family background or connection to be elected as our first female president. And also, I mean, so her victory is strictly based on her academic performance and as a trusted, policy advisor in the past administration. So, and also actually this is nothing new for Taiwan to have this women in politics. So we had our former vice president, Anita Liu, from 2000 to 2008, our first female vice president. And also I think many people know that our legislature also, you know, the women occupied a very high percentage at 38%, which is a lot higher than our neighboring countries or like countries in like US. So, and also our the chairwoman of our largest opposition party, Hong Xiu-Ju, is also women. So you can see it's really a common trend in Taiwan that can do whatever it wants for women. And so next I would like to talk about the current situation in Taiwan and also how we work with the United States to promote women empowerment. So in 2013, the first time that our female population exceeds the male population, so about, now it's about 50 to 49, something like that. And in 2014, we see the first time that women in receiving higher education in college and master degree also surpassed the population of male. So because of that, I think quality education is the key driver for women to have a higher participation rate in labor force. So in 2015, we see now the rate is 50.74. So that's, we've come a long way, because during the past, 10 or 20 years, it's been like about 40 something percent, and eventually we climbed to over 50%. And however, the challenges remain, like women only earn 83 cents for every dollar men make. So there's still like a salary difference. And also in 2014, 2.5 million of women chose to earning up out of job markets because of family reasons. That's 60 times higher than men in Taiwan. So you can see this gender stereotype is still an issue. So like Japan, we are also facing a serious, you know, aging society and the shrinking population issue. So the government has been, I think it's a gradual process. I mean, since the law, the act of gender equality employment law was promulgated in 2001, then we started, and with many amendments, now we gradually have more and more incentives and protection for women to address the main challenge, I think, is of course childcare and elderly care. So for childcare, so now I can give you some examples of the regulations. So now women can have, you know, 8 weeks of maternity leave with full pay, and for the next 6 months, you can get 60% of pay for so half pay leave. And then you can get another, maybe up to, then the leave is up to 2 years, but the remaining is unpaid leave. So that's really a help for women to at least to be willing to have babies. And then also the Taiwanese employers of, you know, more than 100 people need to provide like nursing facilities or, you know, childcare facilities. So. And also, for even for father, you can get like 5 days paternity leave. And also, we have all kinds of subsidies. And also, like, you can, but sometimes the laws are not fully, I mean, implemented. You know, it's always, it's the same case for many countries. We can talk about that later. And for elderly care, so last year, the government, our legislature passed this Long-Term Care Service Act, and it's been like 5 years.